Hello, Global Theater. My name is Jerry Fielka. Today is January 31, 2025. We want to thank Rob Grant and his amazing podcast, I'm Probably Wrong About Everything. Also want to thank Joe Green for introducing us to today's guest, David T. Ratcliffe. Dave, where in the heck are you calling in from?
Place called Rosendale, Massachusetts, supposedly part of the city of Boston.
First question is, what is the best thing for a human being?
For some of this, I must plead deficiency with the memory clerk, who is not as forthcoming as he used to be. So in some cases, like this one right now, I'm going to read something short that answers that question, because I thought a lot about this. To explore what it means to love oneself, and from this to love others, including all our relations. As Orin Lyons put it, quote, we always said that we have been told and understand that we're relatives, where our white brother will talk about water and trees and animals and fish as resources. We talk about them as relatives. That's a whole different perspective. If you think that they're relatives and you understand that, then you're going to treat them differently. And I would say you're going to treat them differently and you're going to relate to them as relatives.
Fellow human beings. Beautiful. Orin Lyons. How do you spell his name?
O-R-E-N. Last name L-Y-O-N-S. He is sure. Of the Onondaga in the Haudenosaunee, the Iroquois. He's the faith keeper of the Onondaga.
Beautiful. What's your favorite form of information, how it comes into you?
It's certainly reading books and I have in times in my life been very tuned into my dreams, keeping a dream journal. And I found that the more I wrote them down, the more inside would, he's paying more attention. Let him remember more. So dreams and also music, specifically piano, classical, Beethoven, Mozart, Bach form, but also 20th century. There's about five or six, eight inspirations of me, genius musician, pianists that music is our universal language, our species universal language. I tune into a specific form of it, and it carries a great deal of experience and feeling that's expressed in a very different form than words. So I can hear in my mind, in my heart, a great deal of the songs that I've loved so much in my life. I tend to just hear the same things, but it's a fairly large catalog of stuff from the 20s up into the 60s, I guess, or 70s. So maybe those three things.
Beautiful. Did you become a reader, one, because your parents told you to, two, they did as an example, or three, on your own?
Probably a combination of the first two. My father was a general surgeon. My mother grew up in China. They were married for 19 years. I was the youngest of four. And I remember coming down in a weeknight after entering first, second, third, fourth grade, in the evening, in the weeknight, I want to watch television. My dad say, have you done your homework? Yeah. Well, can't you do something else? he really, and I get it at this point. I mean, television's quite a thing, but I did find reading was something that I could understand how it worked pretty well. I teach piano and I tell, especially kids in reading music, kids who like to read books as they're in school growing up, if they like to read, then the same kind of thing of using your eye to track across a line of words and be able to jump down to the next line, which I remember doing very clearly in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade with my finger. And the hardest thing was jumping to the next line. But I found that kids who like to read can get a better hook handle on reading music notation because their eye is more practiced at tracking across the page.
Really good. Why do you think humans collect or gather information?
I think it's somewhat as it's in kind, it's is a part of the utter incomprehensible mystery of whatever is really going on here.
Yeah.
While we inhabit these human overcoats that we've been gifted to wear, and I know nothing about past lives or anything else, I don't know, but to be self-directed and autonomous, and it's astonishing and extraordinary. So to gather information would certainly be on one level to an attempt with thinking to try and make sense of the world we find ourselves living in, and maybe even to find some level or dimension of it that somehow really sings to us, that we feel a very individual, personal kind of connection with, that then we're drawn more into that. Maybe it's a way of trying to find more of whatever we're born with, but we have to find our way to really get to it. It doesn't just reveal itself probably for most people.
Dude, that's so heavy. I'll just interject this really quick. Holden Caulfield in Catcher in the Rye says, when you're reading a book and he's speaking to you, it's like the author is your friend. It's like you're having a talk with your friend. And then the guy who shot John Lennon had a copy of Catcher in the Rye in his back pocket. And John Lennon said the same thing in the $100 Beatle book. He says, when I was reading Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce, it felt like I was talking to a friend. Like, that is sort of creepy, you know, in your political research world, when you find these little connections, it's like, what? Okay, but is this need, Dave? And you're really poetic. I appreciate your words. You're a wordsmith, man. This is really fun. You get it. Okay, why do you think humans collect or, no, I already asked you that. Is this need or want to collect information more innate or more invented?
I think it's clearly innate because of whatever physiological and psychic energies were conceived with and then gestated and born and grow up with. One thing you said about reading like a friend, that reminds me very much. In the late 90s, I was seeing a homeopathic person who was helping with some stuff in my chest, and he gave me two books, a pair of books by Lorenz van der Post, the original, the first white chronicler of the Kalahari Bushmen. His ancestors were French Huguenot, and they left France and went to South Africa. They had to escape because they were persecuted. And he had a Bushman nurse who was essential to him in his life. And he wrote the first book about race prejudice, The Dark Eye in Africa, in 1926, an incredible writer. And he wrote these two books, A Story Like the Wind and A Far Off Place. And I read them in 98 or 99 or something. And I immediately turned around and read them again because I felt just like that. This is a friend here in this beautiful, poetic kind of a story of a life story. So I get that thing very much about Catcher in the Rye and Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah. But is this need or want to collect information more innate or more invented?
I think it's innate. It's born into us. I think we're just wired that way. I don't like the illusion, but we are that way.
Yeah. Do thoughts create emotions?
They can, but I think the original thoughts come from, call it feelings, which are, you could say, well, those are emotions. They're emotions and there's thought. But thought is also the past tense of thinking. And they're two very, very different things. And I'll talk about that more as we go on, maybe.
But, oh, that's good. Yeah.
But I think more so, we initially, as we're experiencing the world, we have feelings about things, which then engender certain kinds of thinking, which goes into the memory and becomes thought. But in the present tense, it is thinking, not thought.
Yeah. Dave, fill in the blank. I don't know what I think until I...
Either if something comes up from the memory that I'm reminded of something that the instant moment triggers, or it's either something that I'm reminded of that then is renewed in the present moment with whatever the moment is, or I think it is something that I feel that then makes thinking happen. But that's good. Yeah.
Can humans think without language?
Yes. They can very clearly think without, well, and we have to define language. So if you're talking about words making these little mouth noises that you and I are doing, thinking we understand the meaning that each other is expressing. That's one thing. But I do think, as I said before, music doesn't use necessarily, if it's not with song lyrics, it doesn't use words, and it is very, very expressive in a way that communicates potentially worlds of awareness and sense of beauty and other things. So ask the question again. I'm drifting.
No, it was good. Can humans think without language? You answered it well. We're going to get into it more, because here's what Chomsky said. Language is not just words. It's a culture. It's a tradition. It's a unification of community, a whole history that creates what a community is. What do you do when language doesn't work? When language breaks down, what do you do?
Things that are less, I guess, intellectual. The Jungian compass has four poles: intellect, feeling, sensation, intuition. I understand that I have a very pronounced intellectual part. And I learn more and more that there is also a fair amount of the feeling that's there, that's the side of that. I learned in my 30s much more about my intuitive self, and sensation is maybe in some ways, well, it's just different. To answer your question, I think sometimes I will sit at the piano and play either just total muscle memory, something that I've taught myself, I've learned, or perhaps... recent years, I'm trying to relearn things I used to be able to play very well previously, but I let them fade away. So I'm trying to bring them back, and the muscle memory is kind of there initially. So that's, I tried meditation in my 20s. I couldn't do it. But that to me is a kind of meditation. I tend to lose myself in just the fingers on the keys and the whole thing of the music, the piano.
Beautiful. Your observations of humans in general, are we more thinking beings or more feeling beings?
A feeling, because I think feeling is much more ancient in us than the thinking part.
Yeah. Two questions from Alan Turing in the 50s. One is, thinking a function of the soul?
It would appear so, as Mr. Spock would say. It would appear so because the soul is clearly a superset of anything we might call thinking. It encompasses vastness and not understood, not comprehended. Yeah. So, but it is It is an aspect of the soul. Yes.
Second Turing question is, can machines think?
In a very, very crude kind of programmed way, because computers cannot experience mortality, they can't possibly think the way you're asking that the Turing question. I think that artificial intelligence is a very, it's another step along the path from things like learning to split the atom. The thinking mind, the intellect, is capable of extraordinary things. But as I have to bring this up because this is, I have to read this part. No, that's not the right one. I started this website almost 30 years ago, and I have two parts of it that that one of them speaks exactly to what you just said. The perceptional reality of the technologic human transition from an adolescent industrial mind value system based only on asking the question, is it possible to do whatever is being considered, to Gaia sustaining and promoting practices and explorations which must ask the question, is it appropriate?
Yeah.
Is the only possible future of all human activity on our grandmother Earth? Without taking responsibility for everything we participate in here, we condemn to premature termination the exquisite eons of life exploring itself in this dimension. And I think AI is, it's a guy, I can't remember his name now, in 2017 or something. He's American, but he lives in Germany. He wrote a book about how AI, it will kill us or something like that. But he said, AI is, the one sentence definition is, AI is software that writes itself.
Yeah.
Now it draws upon only what's in the programming of the software that it somehow extends, and it can use surveillance 24/7, 365 of everything on the planet, which is now possible, which is happening clearly in most places where there is a camera that's live all the time, that's connected up to NSA or whatever. But it has very specific limits that it cannot go beyond. Primarily because it cannot know what mortality is.
What, you know what NSA stands for? This is a joke.
National Security Administration.
Never say anything.
Okay, that's better.
But what you said, AI is software that writes itself, really helped me a lot. That's really good what you said. And my brother, I think he typed in, you know, this DeepSeek. It just hit the, you know, it's a new chatbot. Have you heard about it?
I've never looked at it.
Anyways, it just came about popular in the last week or something. And I think my brother typed in, who is Jerry Fialka? And he sent it to me, and it is 98%. Right on with the choice of words, but there's a few little things that are so off that it's like, well, I shouldn't say 98, I should say 80% ish. Pretty amazing, the choice of words. I mean, it was really well done, but the 20% that's off is like, what the heck? Where did they get that? So they're really good what you just said there. Dave, do you more pursue happiness or more pursue meaning?
We'll talk all about meaning. That's where it's all at.
Well, Viktor Frankl said in Man's Search for Meaning, meaning tends to last and happiness doesn't tend to. Does the brain more detect consciousness or create it? Like, is consciousness there bubbling away and we're more so detecting it or more so creating it?
I guess it would, I would guess that it might be a combination of the two. I like very much Joe Green's sense that we are all receivers and transmitters. And in that way, Jung's collective archetypes, there's all of this stuff that we can't begin to rationally explain, but it's very clearly there.
Yeah.
Symbols and things that are very innate within our souls, within our consciousness.
Yeah.
And it's another one of those things that we can talk a lot about it, but I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think it's both. It's good what you said there. And Joe, quoting Joe, that was good. What's faster, speed of light or speed of thought?
Well, I like Joe's take where he said that they've done research recently where 7 or 8 seconds before we say something, the brain already has bubbled up what's going to be said, which makes sense to me. So speed of light or speed of thought, or speed of what?
Speed of light or speed of thought, what's faster?
Yeah, okay. I think they're certainly close to being a tie. Speed of light's pretty fast. but when you think about all that we've stored up, of all the experiences we've lived, which go on the memory, and it's a combination of feelings and thinking and the experiential part,
yeah, of things.
And this, the heart mind connection. There's a place called HeartMath in Santa Cruz or something that I used to know about when I lived in Santa Cruz. It's in the mountains, I think. And they have done all this work. They were doing all this work 30 or more years ago on the heart mind or the heart brain connection, and how they're really tightly coupled. So you think about all the time that we dwell in these human overcoats, that pump is always going. I go swimming 3 days a week at 7 a.m. I swim about a half an hour. At times I'll do some laps. I'll hold up my arm and I'll see the thing. Boom, 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 boom. It's going.
Oh,
so
yeah.
And
wow.
So that coupled with all of the stuff that the heart mind is doing to keep the body alive and flush out all the stuff, the breath and breathing into the lungs and coming out within less than a minute, the whole circle of the oxygen molecules and then the respiration. It's so extraordinarily vast and wondrous. So,
dude, you are an inspiration. What year were you born, Dave?
1955.
55. Yeah, I was born in 53, same age. I got to interject this question because you seem healthy and swimming 3 days a week. That's smart. Do you think does longevity more lifestyle choice or more DNA? I know it's both and it depends, but just your little hunchy guess. Is it
it's a great question I think of John Goffman, who I worked with, Dr. John Goffman, MD, PhD, and he said he did all this work on radiation. He was way ahead of his time, and I was gifted to be able to work with him to put a ton of his stuff on the internet. And he said something to the effect, I was lucky to get good genes.
And
there's that part of it. But also, I don't know. I had a root canal on Monday. And I was so grateful that I got to go have a root canal because they were going to save this old molar in the back that had a silver crown. So it was really old. And I got to this guy from my regular dentist. He pointed me to this guy who was just a genius. And as he was drilling away and everything, I thought, and he said, your roots, the outside root, the third one, is about 25 millimeters. The average root is about 18 to 20. I had these honking roots. And I was thinking as he was talking, I was just given this incredible body. I was given this incredible life force that I was blessed with when I was conceived and born. What a lucky son of a gun.
Yeah, dude. Well, how did you, are your parents still living?
No, my mom died in 92. My dad died in 89.
What age?
She was 92 and he was, no, wait a minute. He was 89 when he died and she was 92 when she died.
Yeah.
So that certainly would help. My mother's father lived to 95. So there's some luck there.
Yeah, you got some. Andre Lord, the poet, says you can't dismantle the master's house using the master's tools. Yvonne Rainer, a colleague, said, oh, you can if you expose the tools. What new tool do you suggest?
I added you to the radical list, which I've been making for about 30 years. And the thing that I sent out on whatever day it was, Monday or something, is something I think that speaks to that. If I can just quickly call it. Well, let me go here. Hold on a second. I titled it The Third Freedom. And yeah. what it's built on is this magnificent book titled The Dawn of Everything. And here we go. The Dawn of Everything by two authors. It came out in 2021. David Graeber and David Wengrow. David Graeber, I believe it was, died a couple of weeks after the book was published in 2021. Yeah. It's a magnificent book. And one of the questions that it asks, because they're an archaeologist and anthropologist, and they've spent about 10 years sifting the last 20, 30 years worth of recent discoveries in archaeology to consider looking at the last tens of thousands of years of our human ancestors to consider something different than either Rousseau's thing, Jacques Rousseau, about they ran for their chains once they created agriculture, or Hobbes's thing that humans are just brutish and brutal and that's just the way they are. They're rather depressing things out of the earlier years of the Enlightenment in the 1700s from Europe. They, near the conclusion's end, I put out a huge chunk of the conclusion of the book because I felt they did a great job of summarizing the book. Near the end, it said, what is the purpose of all this new knowledge if not to reshape our conceptions of who we are and what we might yet become? If not, in other words, to rediscover the meaning of our third basic freedom, the freedom to create new and different forms of social reality.
Yeah.
And from that, as Buckminster Fuller said, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete.
Dude, that is so brilliant. Bucky's the man. And Bucky nailed it. He says, all passengers, no crew.
That's right. Operating manual for Spaceship Earth. That's right.
That's I love it. You, going through your website, I was like blown away. John Trudell, Guy Debord, Thomas Merton, Wendell Berry. I was like, this guy is amazing, man. Where'd you come from? So that was good. So the new tools, the third freedom. Wow. Mind blowing. What new toy do you suggest?
A new toy would be words are not as forthcoming these days. The memory clerk isn't as sharp as he used to be. Would be to mothball what I've spent 30 years more and more and more engaged in. The electronic with, going backwards in time, cell phones, computers, things that basically more and more and more isolate us. And yeah. I think of late, I've thought anew about cars and how cars are like isolation tanks.
Totally.
We get in a car, we annihilate space and time, We go really fast and we're not aware of it at all. We're not grounded. We're not connected to anything. We don't see the world really going by. We just see, it's almost like being watching television. And so there's a great deal of technologic, as John Trudell describes, that erases memories. Its purpose appears to be erasing who we are.
Yeah.
So the new toy somehow is to regain our grounding in the earth. And that sounds, I don't know, pie in the sky or whatever, because of where things are at. But I don't see how what's happening now has much more longevity to it. I just think Katie Singer is a fabulous writer. She's just the bee's knees, and she's informed me greatly on a whole host of levels. She wrote a thing that I leveraged off of it's really, really good. Engaging, I call it Electrify Everything. I gotta find this thing, hold on a second. And in the top of that, this is very, very relevant. I don't have everything in my fingertips. I wish I did. She's talking about power, like things like the electric grid that is currently wanting to be electrified everything by Sierra Club and Mother Jones and all this stuff, Citizens Climate Lobby. The challenge there is it's built on a grid that was created about 125 years ago. And because of that, it was built for that time, which is not like now, where among other things, you have data centers, which drink an enormous amount of energy for all the internet. The internet's the largest thing humans have ever built, as she writes. But this goes back, I have it, Discovering Power's Traps, A Primer for Electricity Users is her title. I call it Electrify Everything? And then that title. At the top of that, I quote Langdon Winner from The Whale and the Reactor, 1986, as cited in Gerrymander, we'll come back to him, In the Absence of the Sacred, where Langdon Winner writes, the most interesting puzzle in our times is that we so willingly sleepwalk through the process of reconstituting the conditions of human existence. Why is it that the philosophy of technology has never really gotten underway? Why has a culture so firmly based upon countless sophisticated instruments, techniques, and systems remained so steadfast in its reluctance to examine its own foundations? In the 20th century, it is usually taken for granted for improving the human condition stem from new machines, techniques, and chemicals. Even the recurring environmental and social ills that have accompanied technological advancement have rarely dented this faith. We are seldom inclined to examine, discuss, or judge pending innovations. In the technical realm, we repeatedly enter into a series of social contracts, the terms of which are revealed only after the signing. Yeah. That was written in 1986. That's almost 40 years ago. Very, very perceptive, very cognizant and conscious and expressing consciousness.
Langdon Winner.
Yeah.
Dude, 20 years before that, he wrote about Captain Beefheart in Rolling Stone magazine in his article, Blew Our Minds. And then he's such a heavy, is he still living?
I don't know.
I would love to have him on my podcast. That was amazing.
We'll have to look him up. We'll have to find him.
But if you can email me the link to that thing you just read, that's really important. Yeah. At the end. But, also, what you talked about, two things you evoked a lot, Dave. That's what James Joyce is basically saying in Finnegan's Wake, is that electricity and the radio are the hidden ground here. And people don't realize, when you go social media, I go, yeah, well, social media, that's talking, right? We invented that year. No, Wikipedia defines social media as when electricity came in. So that they say social media is when the telegraph started. That's when social media said as a genre. So I agree. Most people don't realize the hidden ground to all this is electricity. You know,
two things from Katie Singer, I learned about specifically Rudolf Steiner in the 20s or the teens. I forget the date, where Steiner was very clear that with electricity, I can't remember how he put it. I wish I could look it right up, but something to the effect, we've lost our ability to understand our world because we don't understand what happens when we turn on a light switch.
Yeah.
So exactly. We're completely cut off from that kind of knowing
what. Knowing what, your tool, how your tool. If a pencil runs out of ink, you go, oh, you go fill it with lead or you go buy a new pencil. My friend Clinton Ignatoff, who knows one of the greatest McLuhan scholars in the world, he says, and he's young, a lot younger than us, he says, the problem is no one knows how to fix their computers or their cell phones. Yeah, we grew up fixing our cars. You know, we could fix our cars or we could attempt to fix them. But it's So that's, you lost the ability. Rudolf Steiner, very good. Yeah, so we're going to get deeper into all this. And your two answers were mind-blowing, tools and toy. What and that is, the toy is regaining our grounding in the earth. What could be more practical? Dave, I ask this question sometimes to people. I'm not going to ask it to you right now, but it is, so what's going to be after the internet? And they go, oh, blah, 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 and they guess, or they, and when they go, we'll go back to the earth. I go, we already went back to the earth. I mean, what's the new thing? And it really is. The beauty is when they say that, get back to the earth, regaining the earth, you can stay grounded in the earth in today's sensory overload of electricity. It is hard, but you can do it.
I tell my students, especially the younger students, sometimes they'll actually play with their legs crossed or something. And I just say, even though we're not literally on dirt ground, please put both your feet on the floor because there is a grounding there that happens that helps to be much more hooked into what you're doing with fingers on the keys, whether you're reading music or just playing. Grounding is very, very significant.
Very beautiful words there. What do you worry about when you go to bed at night?
I a lot of things, but I sense that things are really reaching an apex. They've been doing that for a long time, and with the kind of manipulations of subterranean government programs and agendas that are very, very dangerous, nay, call them unconscious, evil, whatever. One thing could certainly be nuclear winter, and that's it, at least for us. Some things will survive in thousands or tens of thousands of years. Something else will come around again. But the danger of the proxy war in Ukraine or just craziness in the Middle East between something like Iran and Israel and the horror genocide that Israel is doing thanks to U.S. military procurement, on and on and on. The fading of the global U.S. hegemon since World War II, it hasn't been fading then, but it certainly is now, is, as JFK would say, those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. I don't know about revolution, but I do know about disintegration. I think that there's a great deal that's very, very propped up, and that things are already in stages of collapse in different parts of the world, in different levels, political, financial, social, economic, religious, psychic. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. And that does seem to be something of a cycle that maybe is entwined with something like global capitalism. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's thus every day is a gift, and gratitude is the best medicine. And that's easy for me to say because I've been blessed my whole life with all kinds of wonderful things. But the worrying stuff, I guess it's just, but I get to live today. So at least I get to live today, and that's good.
Really great. You're inspiring, man. McLuhan learned from a poet that artists are the antenna of the race. They're broadcasting and detecting the hidden psychic effects of our inventions, so we might learn how to cope with what we don't like about our inventions. So, Dave, I ask you the question Marshall probed his whole career. Why do we ignore the hidden psychic effects of our inventions, even though the artists are broadcasting them to us?
One form that makes that difficult is the kind of media. I mean, you know, in the Cold War decades, they would lambaste communism for its state press. But we now have a corporate empire state press. Well, we've had it for a long time. And so the narrative that is broadcast not just on monetized commercial media, but also on a lot of what is called alternative media, because they get their funding from Soros or whoever they get it from.
Yeah.
It's very, very pervasive. And as wonderful Gerrymander wrote in 1977, which I found on Mother Earth News in the, I think, later 90s or early 2000s. I have a complete copy in hypertext of Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television on Radical. And I just recently took it from a early 2000s kind of crummy thing and put it into something that works on smartphones as well.
Yay!
As
yeah.
The younger types really, you know, they live on their phones. Four Arguments for Elimination of Television, as John Judge, which we both know was a very, very inspired soul, beautiful, beautiful soul, as he was wont to say, think of what the Nazis would have given for television. They would have cut off their saluting arms for television. So it's a very, very, very powerful medium, and it's very difficult to not be pulled into some form of it. I am, and to some degree. But I think it's very pervasive. And you know, like you said about social media, well, as far as something like Facebook was, the CIA was originally one of the big funders of creating Facebook. What's a better way to collect data on everyone than to have them give it to you whole hog of their own volition by talking all about themselves on this thing?
Yeah.
So it's just more of that kind of ingrown death creating kind of system. We've reached kind of the end of that.
But you got there deep, because you touched on something I want to say. But why do humans ignore it? You said because TV is state press, so they're aware that they're getting brainwashed. Because I'll tell you two things might continue the discussion on this one. I was always a fan of Walter Cronkite because he seemed to be dependable. But of course, it was still slanted. But, you know, he was one voice. It wasn't like 80 or 100 or a million voices. We kind of had three voices, you know, CBS, NBC, blah, blah, blah. And when the Weather Underground, who were my heroes growing up, blew up a building, they didn't want to kill anybody. They wanted to blow up a building so that Walter would read their manifesto on the news. And he would go, tonight, the Weather Underground blew up another building, and here's why they did it. Then he would read their reasoning. I was like, dude, that is amazing. We didn't realize he was being a tool of their good. But it's like, why do we ignore that artists? I mean, there are TV people who are artists. I mean, look at, you know, who did it the best was Rod Serling. He snuck in, snuck in stuff. Now, why do humans ignore that when the artists sneak in stuff and it's a little deeper, they're telling you a little deeper what the government's doing or what is TV doing or what are, what is paintings doing? You know, CIA was behind abstract expressionism, blah, blah, blah. Why do humans ignore that?
Some of it, I think, is the inertia of there's that dimension, and then there's the whole kind of, and it's not just television. It's newspapers, it's magazines, it's all of this press that is fundamentally driven by economics. We got advertising or whatever we're gonna get our money's worth. And as far as advertising goes, I can find it, gerrymander.
But you're saying that humans in general ignore the hidden of advertising, and that most of this information they're getting is there's a hidden economic motive behind it. Like, you know, watching TV on a Saturday morning cartoons, and they're teaching them to eat sugar cereal. So why do humans ignore that hidden message?
Some of it, I think, is because, at least in as time has gone on, I think there is a deep level of apprehension and fear. Maybe not really on the totally conscious level.
Yeah.
About things are really, we're going to hell in a handbasket.
So just go along to get along. You're saying
as Joe was saying, nobody wants a revolution. You got a new girlfriend, or you just got a house, or whatever else. You want to hold on to that stuff. You don't want to have it all collapse. So let's just keep the boat afloat and keep it sailing on, I think.
They're too busy. That's like, you'll love this one. I heard a lot of the revolutionary leaders, Shea, whoever, they came from rich families, and then they would go to the work. They would go to the working class and go, "You're being screwed. You know, read this. I had the time to read and figure out you're being screwed." And the working class said, "Dude, we're too busy just trying to get food on our table." You know, and sometimes they got over on them. It's that great scene in Berkeley in the 60s, a great documentary. Two of the Black Panthers are going, "Dude, we heard about Mao's Little Red Book, and we went to Chinatown and bought them for the nickel, and then we sold them to the hippies for $5. And eventually we read it, and it was a good book." That's a good example. Well, one other thing, Dave, I love you. You really spur a lot out of my, what do you call that memory guy? Your
memory clerk.
My memory clerk. You're really getting a lot. Do you know who started KTLA, one of the first TV stations in LA? Ex-Hitler employee. That should tell you. Well, look it up. I always get his name wrong. I always say Alan Landsberg. It's something Landsberg. You just look it up. KTLA, who started it in LA, and it's an ex-Hitler employee. Well, you know, it's paper, Project Paperclip. It's all that stuff, you know.
Right.
So, really good. You're fun. Okay. Do artists have moral obligation?
To themselves, to their own moral compass.
Yeah.
And that could be one's upbringing, the society one was born into, one's parents, one's culture. I couldn't see that being something that would in any way be possible to generalize.
Yeah.
It would have to be very specific to each soul's lived experience from the time they were born, and whatever was the kind of guiding voice or light in their soul that would say, "This is right. This is important. This is what I should be doing, and this is something I don't want to have anything to do with, and is not dangerous or wrong or something."
Dave, are you more afraid of new ideas or more afraid of old ideas?
Old is, I think, the thing that keeps things in stasis. The dawn of everything is a wonderful set of new ideas, the new history for humanity. There's so much stuff in there that those guys teased out of their conversation back and forth between them. And 63 pages of bibliography, they really are very, very focused on exploring what else can we imagine besides this particular social reality that seems to only have ended up in domination and violence, and that we've gotten so stuck in this.
Yeah.
But there's other things that the imagination can find that have never yet been identified, maybe.
I think it's exactly what's going on right now. Everybody's like, we're fucked. I was like, get over it and study something and work something out and do something about it. Don't just sit there and go, oh my God, I'm going to wait until they collapse. That's what all my colleagues say, but they're going to collapse soon. Well, maybe. Don't wait. Wait until they collapse. Do something now.
The latter half of 2019, I spent more than 6 months building a new directory called Collapsologie, a French form of the word. Collapsologie, yeah. Immersion. The end is the beginning. Late to the game and eager to learn, can we seed future successor cultures in time?
Yeah.
So that, yeah, absolutely. What can we do now?
Of course we can. Do something. Don't just sit there. Okay, Dave, can you conjure up your earliest memory ever or one of them?
I'm not sure this is the earliest. I do have a memory. I possibly was in a hospital. I don't know when my tonsils were taken out, but I remember I thought it was that I was in some type of crib, not a bed. And in the crib, there was somehow I had a boat toy that was probably at least maybe a foot long or something it was a boat, but it had wheels in the bottom of it and you could put it in water so it wouldn't sink, but it had these wheels. And I vaguely remember almost rolling that boat back and forth.
Really cool. I'm going to turn this light on. Hold on 1 second. So Dave, is memory more a curse or more a blessing?
It has both elements. The years piling up into decades and more, there's the idea, well, your memory runs out of room, so you have to get rid of old ones so you can still have new ones. I don't know about that. I think some of it is just these human overcoats are beyond magnificent and they run down. So over time, I used to have a steel trap memory and I could recite things very well, easily. I can read things now. I can't recite them so well anymore. But some of the memory, certainly, my parents divorced when I was 10. It kind of fried my circuits. In some ways, it caused me to, I think, probe more deeply about what is this? I need to understand, because nobody was explaining anything to me.
Yeah.
My mother said in the 70s, she was getting her psychology degree after they divorced in 66 or so. She wished that both she and Dad had taken all four of us aside multiple times and said, Dave, Mom and Dad are having really hard times and has nothing to do with you. We both love you very much. And maybe that would have helped some, but since there wasn't anything like that, they were in their own private hells. They couldn't see straight for that.
Yeah.
So I had to figure it out. And I have done that for decades. And one guy, George Hogel, a Jungian analyst that I saw in the 80s, he was one of the granddaddy Jungians of the Bay Area. My mother, my brother's first wife, Ashley, and my second mother, Carol Hills, all knew George Hogel in certain ways. And they suggested, after I got this dream job at Silicon Graphics, computer graphics company, first the place that made real-time 3D graphics for the first time in 1986, they said, maybe you should go see if you can. They mentioned George Hogel, and I knew he was getting ready to retire. And so I went to see him once in Woodside, and we talked for an hour. And I said, so who could you recommend? And he said, well, maybe we can work something out, because he clearly was curious about me.
Yeah.
So we worked together for 4 years, 3 days a week, dreams and everything else. And that helped a lot too. I've seen a lot of people before and since then, but I have this feeling compelled to understand who I am and where it's all come from. And the memories are more neutral now than they used to be. And you said, though, about memory, restate the question, because I'm not answering the full part.
You answered it. Is memory more a curse or more a blessing? It's a stupid question. Of course, it's both. But here's the thing. 80% of people go, what's a blessing? And people sometimes go with certainty, no, it's a curse. Yeah. So, I mean, I just want to interject. What's George's spelling on his last name?
I believe it's H-O-G-L-E. He passed sometime maybe in the 2000s.
Okay. And then here's a cliche. I'm not saying it's true, but they say if your parents divorce before you're 17, you're fucked. So you took it and you flipped a breakdown into a breakthrough. You at 10, you said, what the fuck is this? I'm going to be aware for the rest of my life. And if that didn't happen, you might have been a different person. Who knows? But just to clarify, did your parents have four kids?
I was the youngest of four. Yep.
Youngest. Okay. So, you know, that's heavy what you did with that.
I certainly didn't say anything at the time about I'm going to figure this out, but organically.
But there's something there's something, Dave, that was a turning point in your life. I mean, but that's the next question. Tell me someone within your immediate family, and you can define immediate family as you want, that had an impact on you, and what was that impact?
Well, there really would be three people then. There would be my mother, father, and Carol Hills for different reasons.
Okay. What did you mainly get from your mom? What did you mainly get from your dad? And what did you mainly get from Carol?
From my mother, I got the worldview of a person who grew up third culture. She grew up in China from 1925 to 1940. So she really did not have the kind of worldview that her contemporaries had growing up in the United States.
Yeah.
And she was very, she, because of that, she was, I think, more, she had a wider sense of the world and of humanity
She's one step removed. That's why McLuhan's so brilliant. He was Canadian, so he could look at American culture one step. That's from the amazing. Outside. Yeah. Oh, that was good. What'd you mainly get from your dad?
He was a general surgeon, and something I remember very, very well. He worked in three hospitals in San Mateo and Burlingame, south on the peninsula, and I sometimes would accompany him making rounds in the evening, and I'd be five or six and I'd be holding his hand, little guy. And we'd walk into these rooms of people that he'd operated on that day or recent days. And when we walked in, those people would just brighten up because this man had saved their life. This man had cared for them and helped them. And I was very, very struck by what my dad was doing in his life.
He was helping human beings. Yes. That's funny. You said, hold your hand. I thought there's a woman I had, and dude, when either I tear up or you tear up, I know this is a great interview, because this woman she said my dad was a doctor and he would hold his patient's hand. When you said, oh, that is an amazing thing. What doctors, because I grew up with a mom who's a nurse, this sensibility is, because I'm anxious to see, before, is Carol the woman who your dad married? Who's Carol again?
No, but let me back up for just a second with my dad. I was holding his hand because picture a little boy who's probably 3.5 feet.
Right.
And so we're just walking in together and I'm holding his hand because he's leading me in. And so that's
still, that's the touch, the human touch of another, you know. Yeah, I'm dying to know, how did you get, especially when you, if we ever get to your, why'd you go into political research? What, where did you get this positiveness? You know, so, you have a positive, and was that from the way your parents raised you or on your own?
No, I guess it would be in some ways from Carol Hills, and I'll read you. My mother got into some creative writing in the 2000s in her last 12
and how do you spell Carol's last name?
Carol Hills, C-A-R-O-L and then H-I-L-L-S.
Okay, now
Carol, my mother wrote these little pieces for her creative writing, and part of what she wrote about for Carol was actually was her favorite word, and she would say it with a certain intonation, actually. I can't imitate her. Proceeding from there, blow this up a little bit, proceeding from there into some sort of outrageous statement about how she was at that moment feeling towards her most intimate family members, husband, children, gardener, or Mexican housekeeper. She was outspoken, easily tearful, and adored jazz as well as classical music. Often when I came by for one of our sisterly visits, I would find her in their living room seated at one of the two grand pianos, playing her heart out. At parties, she played for applause and fun. Alone at home, she played to unburden her heart. For her, the world, as well as our individual human lives, operated irrationally and deserved tender pity, tears, and forgiveness. Her feeling response to everything was immediate and real. And because this was totally opposite from what my upbringing had provided me, I was fascinated and emotionally released by her. To me, at first, shockingly direct. Feeling expressions. We met when we were both in our mid-30s, I already with three kids, and she without any. Carol became my best friend in the early 1950s, in part because I was more grounded in the doctor's wife's social world she was just entering, while she offered me new learnings about the power of being comfortable with the inner world of honest emotional realities. Number one confidant, she used to call me, as our woman-to-woman relationship blossomed over the many years we both were members of the San Mateo Medical Society. Eventually, she had three children. Her firstborn son and my last son, born 3 months apart, became best friends. Today, 50 years and 3,000 miles apart, they still are. Carol died about 6 years ago, and I still acutely mourn her loss whenever something really sad or awfully funny happens. I find myself silently mouthing words to her when events in our children's lives come to fruition, events she saw the beginnings of all those years ago. I sometimes wonder if she isn't up there looking down on our increasingly complicated world, alternately weeping and laughing over how ridiculous we human beings behave. Her gifts to me were life-changing and beyond expression. She knew she was my dear friend, but I doubt she ever guessed she was also my great teacher.
Wow. So you wrote that, Dave?
No, she did. My mother did.
Your mom wrote that about her friend, about Carol.
And that's a great description of Carol. And Carol, for me, was my second mother.
Your second mother, yeah.
The person who really was able to give me unconditional love. My mom was kind of, my mom was depressed when she was pregnant with me, because she realized by that point that she was going to be on her own because dad was so completely involved in his surgery work.
Right.
And so she and Carol had just had her first child, Oscar, my oldest friend, Ock, 3 months before. So she would park me at Carol's a lot of time, which was great. Here was this incredibly feeling, expressive, totally on the surface, alive woman who loved me completely. And I was part of their family. So that was the feeling axis that she provided me.
So well put. Yeah. Then it was great. You reading your mom's words, it was like they were resonating, and it was as though you wrote them, you know? And so now, I mean, it's, you sort of answered the second question, but this is so fun. Tell me someone outside your immediate family who had an impact on you, and what was that impact?
Well, there's a few. Certainly, John Judge. I've never had a friend like John.
Okay, tell me just briefly, what did you mainly get from John?
A beautiful mind and heart, a commitment to our single, vulnerable, iridescent, supremely fragile human family. Yeah. To do everything within his power to help people understand how our world works, how it actually operates. And his heart was, he had a great heart. I called him Johnny Reb, and he called me Ratty.
Ratty, yeah. But look at, these political researchers, especially of your ilk, they don't tend to, I don't know, maybe it's an unfair generalization, but did he have the same positiveness that you did? It's not like they like, I give up.
No. John was completely dedicated to the furtherance of the human, to the successful furtherance of the human project beyond our industrial mind epoch. Absolutely.
Yeah. Did your parents, go ahead.
Another one was fundamentally Mary Lou Williams, jazz giant, a musician's musician. I lucked out in being able to study with her near the end of her life for 8 months when she had a full professorship at Duke University in North Carolina from 1979, 1980. And that was when I was really able to truly try on the clothes for size about, I want to be a performance musician. This is what it would be. And I realized when I was there, I'm not obsessive, that all I want to do is practice all day and play all night for the rest of my life. But thank God I was blessed enough that I got to try those clothes on for size with an absolutely giant of the genre, a giant of that musical form.
Master, you studied with Mary Lou Williams for 8 months?
Yep.
That is amazing, dude.
I was so effing lucky.
We've got to do a part two and maybe an 8-part Netflix series in this, because I didn't even know this about. Okay, so did your parents raise you a particular religion?
My father, not so. My mother's father was a minister. He was a minister in China. He was one of four ministers in the San Mateo Congregational Church. So we would go to the Congregational Church. The times that I didn't like it so much, I'd go to Sunday school. But the times that were great was when I got to accompany my mother into the church and hear the sermon. And sometimes my grandfather would be the sermon person. And there were times, he was a great raconteur and storyteller. And at times he would make some point about a story that would include members of his family. And at times when I knew he was talking about us, or me, not me so much, but our family, I almost couldn't hold myself from giggling, which you're not supposed to do in church, because I knew
you would giggle. Life. That's good. That was the cosmic giggle. But yes. Dude, that's amazing. Cause I think Dave, what you got from him was the ability to know the value of storytelling.
Huge. No, he was a beautiful, sweet, gorgeous man. I have some paintings downstairs that he did in his last years wife, my grandmother Mary, retired, some of the first retirees, to a place in Carmel Valley Manor. He did these paintings, including one that is, the subject was the Great Divide, and he has sort of the mountains in the background. It's like a primitive Grandma Moses kind of painting, and there's a line coming down, and on the right side are old people, and there's a man with a cane reaching across the line to hippies wearing, you know, fancy swimsuits and whatever, bikinis on the other side. And the man saying, go take a bath. And the hippies are saying, go take a trip. He loved the hippies. He did a sermon, which I have in my papers of him, about how Jesus Christ was the first hippie.
Oh, that is great. Go take a bath. No, go take a trip. That is amazing. So
another one is flags flying in the wind. That was the subject. And what he drew was a big, big metaphorical picture of East and West, communist United States fighting with atomic bombs and the Hell Gate and this big giant thing flying in the air, big windmaker fans of flames. He was so out of time. He was a beautiful, beyond his own time thing. He was great. Do I pray? My stepmom, my dad's second wife, saw the one time that was advertised in the San Francisco Chronicle by the family of the Rod McKays in Eastern Oregon. They'd taken in kids every summer to their ranch. 400 head of range cattle, 20 milk cow, 50 head of sheep, and 9 alfalfa fields. And this one time they advertised in the Chronicle, my stepmom Joanne saw it. And I went there for one summer for 2 weeks. They were 100 miles west of Boise in Eastern Oregon, not knowing what I'd find. And when I left to come home, I was quoting myself as I got on the plane to have to fly back, like MacArthur, "I shall return," because I so loved those people. They were another second family for me. I loved them and they loved me. We did all kinds of Catholic stuff. We went to Catholic church. I did communion, and I tried my darndest to pray to God because there was some things that I had wanted help with. But I guess for me, my Mr. Intellect side, I never felt like there was something on the other end of the line. So yeah. That was then when I was quite a bit younger in my teens. I think in a different way, God as a word is too loaded for me. It has too much baggage, but either Great Spirit or Creator or something. It's something that is unknowable. As Joe said, he recently began to be very clear to himself that there is a Creator. And I do understand that part of it, not in a system basis like a religious system that I think is necessarily very much grounded in a human kind of reality. I think that there's too much going on here that couldn't possibly have just somehow come out of nothing in one instant with the Big Bang. As Rupert Sheldrake or Terence McKenna would say, give us one miracle and we'll explain the rest to you.
you drop all my favorite names, but this is great. Captain Beefheart and Frank Zappa, and as they were dying in their... they were both talking on the phone to each other in before they died. And they both had watched a documentary on the Big Bang. And Frank says to Don, "What do you think came before the Big Bang?" And Don went, "The Big." But here's Harold Bloom. "Do you believe in God? My attitude towards Yahweh is that I don't like him and I don't trust him and I wish he would go away. But listen to this, Dave, but I know he won't because he's built into the language. As Nietzsche said, he's part of the way we think. As soon as you use a verb involving being, you're in trouble." you can say you don't believe in God, or, you know, Louis Bunuel nailed it. He said, "Thank God I'm an atheist." But it is the follow-up question is, if God does exist, what would you like God to say to you after you die?
Well, as an aside first, there couldn't be some kind of a he or a she.
Right.
So anyways,
I didn't gender it. I say, if God exists, what would you like God to say? Because you can't. Yeah, I used to say if she exists, and then it would get into an issue. It's like, whatever.
No, I'm only riffing off of the people you quoted.
Yeah, yeah.
Because okay. What would I like the Creator to tell me?
To say to you, yeah.
You found the greatest wealth of all, which was the connections you made with all our relations, human and otherwise.
Yeah. Dude, that's amazing. Yeah. You found him, dude. You found him. He would be reinforcing your love of humanity. Yeah. But, you know, the joke, Dave, is for all you guys like Joe Green and you and John Judge, what would you like God to say to you? Who killed Kennedy? Come on. and then if God said, well, so-and-so killed him, would you believe him? It's like, how can I believe this guy? He's a fucking bullshit cloud, you know, guy in the clouds or something. You know? Okay, Dave, do evil people exist or does evil use people as a vehicle?
Clearly, I think that part of the answer to that is people that are conceived and born into the lives they were given exert an extraordinary influence on how they grow up and who they manifest as autonomous, self-directed adults.
Yeah.
Someone like Adolf Hitler, someone like Bill Gates, someone like Eichmann, someone who one would say, I remember my father, it was discovered in the seventh grade that I could not subtract, which drove my dad insane. The mind can't subtract in this, and they figured that out in the seventh grade. So I would go to his office, his office where he had his medical practice, for at least a couple of times every week for a couple of weeks or something in the fall of that year. And I remember as we were leaving the building one time, and somehow I came up with the talk turned to World War II or something, and I said, but Dad, if Hitler was that bad, wouldn't God take Hitler after he died and tried to help him or something like that, I said, which elicited tremendous vehement response from him. Dad, Dave, Hitler was a bastard. He was just a bastard. So for him, who was he was in the Navy, but he didn't see action. He was in the Atlantic, but in the latter stages of the war in Europe, he didn't fight in Europe. But nonetheless, he was of that generation, grew up, came of age in the Depression, and then with the he was born in 1919, so actually the Roaring Twenties, and then the Depression, and then World War II. I've read some about Hitler. There was a thing called For Your Own Good. I can't remember the analyst's name. She was some kind of Jungian. I have those books. And that might not have been the name of the thing, but she did a study of Hitler's childhood and everything. And or Gates, someone like Gates, who basically grew up with a silver spoon in his mouth. So he never actually had to struggle with a lot of things that a lot of people would have to, because it was all just given to him. So he just had clear sailing the whole time. No problem. Everything's honky-dory.
Yeah.
So I think someone like that, in some ways, it would appear that someone like that, like Gates, really apparently does not have much access to empathy. I don't get the sense from him that he has that kind of feeling access. Evil as a whole, I mean, all the people that went along with Auschwitz and everything else, and or whatever else they were doing, the Einsatz group and the murder squads that went through Eastern Europe and just did wholesale, dig the huge pits and shoot millions of people into them. As one example, I think that the kind of thing now that is going on with the last 50, 60, 70 years with the U.S. wars around the world that have gone on and on and on, people have to be trained how to kill in a large mass like that, a whole army or a navy or whatever. There does seem to be something that perhaps is outside the realm of human beings that is some kind of energy, maybe, that creates that sort of condition for evil being lived out in humans. You said say the question one last time. I've gone way around the corner on this.
No, you did well. Do evil people exist, or does evil use people as a vehicle? Let me just tell you, a lot of people say we're all capable of evil, because it's sort of like your dad wanted to do what most people did. No, a lot of people answer this question. No, Hitler was an evil person. No, maybe he was a person. Do we forgive him? Let me interject two things. Really fast, because the next question carries on our discussion.
Okay.
James Joyce in Finnegan's Wake has a really good thing. The guy's shooting the guy at the firing squad, and the guy he's going to shoot goes, oh, I got to take a shit. And he goes, I can't shoot you when you're shitting. He had empathy for another human being. Now kids are in Langley with joysticks, and they don't see the face. There's no humanity in killing. So that's a big issue. You brought it up a little there. And then this is a question I used to ask people before Trump got in a second term. I'm like, oh my God, I never thought he would. And it's like, if Trump doesn't get elected, he gets thrown in jail and he writes a book and he says, I'm sorry, I did wrong. Would you forgive him?
I that prompts me to go back to something Jim Douglas, author of JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and What It Matters. He was on in the maybe 2014 or something, some antiwar.com interview, and the woman was pretty aggressive and all this stuff. And she was saying something along those lines about somebody who's just bad. They're just bad.
Yeah.
And Jim's response was, yes, but people can change.
Yeah.
And so forgiveness is, it's a very, very powerful act. Did you see Mary Clerk's Out to Lunch, the guy who did the whole thing on, it was one of the channels, Ted Lasso.
Yeah.
So there's one point where the owner of the team comes in and she tells him that she's lied to him and she's done all this stuff to try and trash him. And he looks at her and he says, I forgive you.
Yeah.
Because she's gone through a divorce and stuff, and he too is in the process of it. He says, I forgive you. Divorce is a hard thing. That kind of forgiveness is something that Jim Douglas talks about a lot, that is very transcendent in terms of not being locked into a rigidity that can't change.
It's amazing. You're really an evolved human. Mark Twain said, forgiveness is the smell the flower gives off when the foot steps on it. Dave, most people, when I asked him that Trump question, I didn't even want to bring up his name, but I'd ask it every once in a while over the last couple of years. Most people would go, no, I wouldn't believe him. You know, but see, you had the empathy, like maybe I would believe him. He's a human being. He never says he's sorry, and he never says he made a mistake. Never. And he's blah, blah, blah. So here's the hidden question. I mean, not the hidden. Here's the carry it on. This is Nassim Taleb, because you can air more thoughts on this very thing. Nassim Taleb said, games were created to give non-heroes the illusion of winning. In real life, we don't know who wins or loses, but we can tell who a hero is. Kind of like you were saying, Ted Lasso was a hero by saying, okay, I forgive you. She recognized that.
Yeah.
Gregory Bateson says that when the criminal gets caught, does he go, whoa, my criminal skills weren't up to snuff that day? Or does he go, oh, I did something morally and socially wrong? So the bottom, it's basically you can go wherever you want and on that hero and right and wrong, but does punishment work?
It would appear not to. It would appear to be more of the same kind of exercise of violence.
Yeah.
That only perpetuates more and more of the same in a never-ending cycle.
Yeah.
In the probably early to mid 90s, I worked at Silicon Graphics for 15 years from 86 to 2001. I lived in Santa Cruz and I would commute to Mountain View over by where the Google buildings are now. SGI used to have those buildings when they were first built. I worked in those buildings. And a good friend, Paul Hansen, and I would drive in our car after a couple. This was after the 1989 Loma Prieta quake, where the road wasn't passable for a couple of months. And I found my way to all of these incredible cassette tape books of David Bohm conducting seminars in Ojai on thought and the nature of thought and consciousness.
Right. Wow.
Listen to these tapes with Paul a lot and by myself. And what I just started doing now, I finally bought myself a USB cassette deck. And I've started to digitize these tapes, especially the first one is the one I actually have a privately published from the place in Ojai in 90 or something. A transcript that Bohm went into afterwards and edited the transcript so it would say just the way he wanted to say. And what he titled that book was Proprioception of Thought.
Yeah.
I began listening to the little things that I load onto an old, old iPod shuffle about probably the second version way long ago. When I'm driving in the car, I started listening to it and remembering, oh, this is just so illuminating. And Bohm was so creative in his soul in seeing things that included this whole way of thought of violence destroys sensitivity.
Yeah.
And there's thinking and there's thought, but in our language, we have no past tense of feeling. So then would use the word felt. So we have feelings and felt, thinking and thoughts. And thought, as he described it, was this aspect of memory, which is all mixed in with the felts of everything we've ever experienced. And the things, like you said, about what happens faster, of thought or speed of light.
Yeah.
The stuff comes in so quickly from the memory, but we're not aware of it because it almost feels like it's just in the moment. But it has all this stuff it's drawing upon, both from thought and from feeling. And I'm going to produce a lot of those things, and I'm going to digitize make a text copy of the Proprioception of Thought. I've wanted to do it for years, and I'm finishing a couple of other big things right now, but that's something I'm gearing up for, because this thing about punishment is it's promulgating more of the same. So yeah. It's the kind of world that thought built that doesn't see what it's doing. It's not understanding the consequences of what it does.
Amazing, Dave. I wrote an essay called Can Art Stop War? And I'm going to send you it. And it's basically based on this thing. When you say, are humans hardwired for violence? And they're like, of course, if they're stealing my food, I've got to protect my family and have the food. And Maria Gimbutas, if you don't know her,
Her up.
Rhian Eisler, she promoted partnership, and basically Maria is saying that we're more hardwired for cooperation than we're hardwired for war. And everybody goes, well, that war we needed. I go, that's bullshit. We don't need any war. Get over it. But you know, that's what my friend taught me, the great Jim Miller, is it's called matristic civilization. The women give birth. And that's why it's not matriarchy, it's partnership, it's matristic civilization. So it's giving birth.
Yeah.
So here's the next one, because I went out of order there. It's really the follow-up to, is there evil or not? How do you advise someone to to deal with an enemy. And I'm going to set it up. Alan Watts says, if you acknowledge your enemy, you empower them. Coppola stole from the mob and the samurai. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. JFK said, forgive your enemy, but don't forget their name. And Fellini says, I need an enemy. So it's a lot of thoughts. You can go wherever you want. The basic question is how do you advise someone to deal with an enemy? But first, how would you respond specifically to the Alan Watts? If you acknowledge your enemy, you empower him.
It would seem that that would be something that would be a benefit to their game.
Yeah.
By responding in kind, you're allowing yourself to be manipulated by their actions.
Yeah.
So there's certainly, Alan Watts was, of course, out of this world, very, very, I don't know about third culture, but he could certainly see into this culture from outside of it.
Exactly.
And
but Dave, then there's the people like you're practical. You know the political researching world. If you don't acknowledge them, you empower them. That's what some people go. They go, oh yeah, I agree with Watts. But they go, well, what if you don't acknowledge them and they're harming you? Is that empower them even more? So, I mean, it's basically, what do you tell people? How do you deal with your enemies?
I suppose I would have to revert to more of a case-by-case thing. All I can say to start with, for myself, I understand that I create archives of things that are mostly wanting to be censored and just ignored.
Hidden history.
Well, hidden history, but also Hidden History Center from John Judge's Museum of Hidden History. I think of it as our living, albeit hidden, history.
Yeah.
Our true living history.
Yeah.
And so at one point I remember Jim Douglas, I heard from another friend or something that there was some talk somehow, maybe during Obama's time, that maybe something was being considered about Jim Douglas maybe receiving the Medal of Freedom or something like that. And I remember Jim saying, well, he'd never do that, or I'd never, you know, accept that because it's just too much in the system. How to deal with one's enemies. I guess it really depends on the definition of what the enemy is doing. What's the enemy's purpose? What's the enemy's goal in terms of the person who's being attacked or maligned or influenced or crushed or badly treated by an enemy? I mean, if it's words, if it's not murderous, like guns or knives or something like that. I do think that in some ways it's best to ignore. Well, okay, here's an example. Here's an enemy that I certainly know about. There's a thing called NewsGuard. And NewsGuard is one of the new creations from 20 or 21 that's all about the Ministry of Truth. And NewsGuard is going to tell you what's okay and what's not. And I've gotten, and this is bad because now I'm acknowledging, if they ever tune into this, they'll know, oh, he's finally responding in an indirect way to us writing to him. I've got a thing from over four separate years, from 21, 22, 23, and 24, by this guy who's saying, you know, we're trying to qualify every source and what's your funding? All this kind of crap. Do they do that with JP Morgan? Do they do that with AstraZeneca? No, they just do it with people that they don't like.
Right.
The people who are actually not adhering to a narrative and saying, hey, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of being able to create your own sense of whatever you think is the most important things. Isn't that like some kind of thing called the Constitution First Amendment? No, not really. No, no, we can't do that anymore. So it's become more and more and more and more corrupted. And a good friend advised, don't ever respond to them.
Don't respond. Dave, I got to interject because one of our heroes said, as I.F. Stone said, the truth as I see it, because that's the bottom line. And then, you know, the other one is Walt Whitman. I no doubt deserve my enemies. So I mean, like you know, you tackled it well. You're a logical thinking person. You would suss out the situation and all the details. If your friend came to you and said, Dave, so-and-so is bullying me, what would you say to them? Ignore them or, you know, confront them? Like in that sort of basic situation.
So in that case, I guess it would depend on what nature the bullying was taking, how it was working.
Yeah.
If it was verbal or whatever, and it had really bad effects on, you know, the person's sense of self or whatever, or friends or you know, social environments that they were living in. I might be inclined. I guess it really depends on one approach might be that I would attempt to meet the person who's doing the bullying and say, what's your point? What are you trying to get here? I know this other person and I'm connected to them and they've told me about this and I want to hear from you. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Why is a pretty limited question. What are you doing? What is it that you are intending? What's your goal? That would be one way. If it seemed like that wasn't possible, I guess I'd find out from the friend if there was any way that they could draw on some, if it was really some kind of maligning that was affecting their career or whatever else, if there was some way that they could draw upon some sort of third party go-between that could neutralize the dynamic.
Yeah,
I don't know. That's pretty vague.
No, it's good. We tackled a lot. And, you know, Dave, this has really been enlightening for me. And I hope we can plan a part two because we basically got through 11 questions. And I loved every minute of it. Believe me.
Count me in. I'd love to.
Yeah, because, dude, this is why I do this is because I want to get deeper with people and not just have them tell me their stock lines. But in your case, you would actually read your kind of stock lines, but they were so enlightening and it was just your way. I tell you, my dad, he lived till he's in his 90s, early 90s, and he had dementia or, you know, Alzheimer's at the end. And so I know over the last 3 years, I've been like, if I don't write it down, I'm like, why did I forget that? And I know I'm losing it, and that's all right. So I went to the doctor, and I says, could you do a test? And she did the test. She goes, no, you're fine. She goes, if you look at your keys and go, what are these for? You're in trouble. If you lose your keys, that's normal.
That's good.
So I like how you talk about the memory dude. What do you call him? I got to write it down. The memory
clerk.
The memory clerk. Yeah. But it is like, I thought when I went to research your websites, it was just amazing how extensive, like you, Joe Green, all you guys, there's someone else in Texas that I've been interviewing. I forgot his name.
Richard Bartholomew.
Yes, he's great. It's such, and what I really want to do, you know, I do a tour of three or four parts with you. I want to do a salon with all three of you at once.
Great. Wonderful.
You know, because it's really deep what you guys are doing, and you don't have the fear. That's what I like. You're like, no, this is important. I'm a researcher. It should be available.
That's totally what John Judge was. He had no fear.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely dedicated and devoted to our human family.
Yeah. But how do you find, I mean, again, did you get that fearlessness from your parents, the way they raised you, from John? How did you get the fearlessness?
Probably from a lot of sources, maybe starting with my parents in the way of they had different senses of how we should be raised. So we were getting two different kind of levels of direction that weren't, yeah, that weren't at all coincident, but that was fine. Yeah. But then, so where's the book? So I'm finally making a second edition of this interview I did with Walter Prouty.
Yeah.
And I'm more than halfway along. I've got most of the technical details worked out. It's still a ways to go, but it's going to be a very good second edition. And I, as I've written in other places, I more and more and more, I really have become driven by the desire, the urge to do the best I can to understand how our world actually operates.
Yeah.
And as I write in part of the epilogue of this thing, the first time I really keyed into that was 1977. And I was in New Haven, Connecticut, and I was in a house with a guy who was a lawyer, and a good friend loaned me a copy of Schlesinger's 1,000 Days, John F. Kennedy in the White House, 1965. And wow. I'd never read dry biography before. And it was very powerful going through it. And I was 8 when he died. I was homesick that day. I only remember my father coming up the stairs into the second floor on a landing where if he turned 180 degrees, he'd come down into my room. I was propped up in my bed sick. But he just said, I said, "Hi, Dad." And without turning towards me, he simply said, "President Kennedy's been shot." And then he walked the other way to go out of the view into their bedroom. That's all I remember of the weekend. That's my remembrance of the assassination. It was finally 14 years later when I read this book that I had this thing woken up inside me and realized something about what this man was trying to do.
Yeah.
And from there, I read everything I could on his life and Robert's life and also Martin King and to some degree Malcolm X. I read Malcolm autobiography of Malcolm X. And that got me into the 80s. Other things happened in my life. And finally, in 84, when I was in Santa Cruz, going back to school, getting a computer science degree, I started listening to Mae Brussels' World Watchers. So that was really, really opening up. That's how I met John, through Tom Davis, Mae's bookseller.
Yeah.
And then in 86, I came across this thing. This is core. This is something that would make anyone want to go deeper. Rosalie Bertell was a PhD in biometrics, and she was also a gray nun. And she wrote stuff in the 1985. She wrote a book called No Immediate Danger, Prognosis for a Radioactive Earth. And I found a recording that I made a transcript of in 1986 called Quietly Eating Radioactivity. And in the recording she gave in Vancouver, she gave the speech to a group of community broadcasters in Vancouver. It was called Quietly Eating Radioactivity, and a couple of quotes, excerpts from it. She said, "As things get tighter and as money gets shorter, the thing that's sacrificed is always health. There's no justice issue which does not result in a violation of human health. Every time there's a justice issue, somebody gets sick. It's quite clear. We have a right to know what's in our food. But the problem is just quietly going underground, and everybody's just quietly eating radioactive food, and they're going to be quietly getting cancer and quietly having deformed babies. We will quietly undermine the rest of the integrity of the gene pool and the integrity of the earth. At some point or other, if we survive, there's going to have to be a massive non-cooperation with our society, which is producing death. And if we are ever to break out of the militaristic society that we live in, and that is what I think is our basic aim, because that's what's distorting everything, it's going to have to be through an across-the-board non-cooperation effort. It's this preoccupation with producing death and instruments of death and mega-death. This is our root sickness. We're not choosing to live on this planet. We're choosing to kill it. If we're going to turn that around, it's going to require massive non-cooperation, and it's going to have to be basically people-to-people networks built on trust, because you're trusting the future and you're trusting your life." And so when I thought, when that kind of stuff in the mid-80s, it just, it opened it up a much wider kind of view. I mean, Kennedy was talking about to whoever his science advisor was in early 63 when it was raining outside. And he was saying, you mean radioactivity is coming down in that rain? And the guy said, yes. So he knew, he understood very well. He'd almost lost his life a whole bunch of times. He almost died in World War II, saving his shipmates in the PT-109. He knew from lived experience, he had that wisdom and he had that intuition, not just the intellect, which he had massively. So it was already known, but it just that kind of incoherence, that kind of, no, we're just going to do this though anyways, because it's really good. No, it's really not. But you have the financial resources, or whatever, that you want to develop nuclear power, and you can't have nuclear weapons without nuclear power. They're the same, opposite sides of the same coin. That stuff by middle 80s, it really just more and more and more, God, this is really difficult and it needs to be somehow understood as much as I can. And then anybody who will listen to me, maybe I can share it with them.
Yeah, you've shared it well. And it's amazing. Reading that was so beautiful, Dave, because it evokes so much of those two words my friend says, matristic civilization. We're civilized humans, and these women are telling us, because Rachel Carson did it in the 60s with Silent Spring. And, you know, no one knew the word pollution. And I'm from the town of Flint, Michigan. And we knew that the word pollution existed before it was even in the lexicon, because they said, don't swim in the Flint River. It's polluted from GM, General Motors. Wow. And we knew that. So then when the water crisis hit Flint a few years ago, it was like, yeah, they were saying that, like, we knew Flint had water problems years ago, and now it's a reality. So, you know, I really appreciate your dedication, and you are fearless. That's the beautiful thing. Dave, I'm going to hit the end broadcast button now, but I hope this never ends, and I look forward to setting up part two. We keep talking forever and ever and keep moving forward with positiveness. Thank you for enlightening, you know, staying positive and communicating a lot. It's not just positive. It's like you have a sense that there's a lot to communicate and we can communicate it. So thank you so much.
Gratitude for your having me on. I'm so grateful. Thank you.
Dave, we'll meet again, my friend. Thank you.
Wonderful.
All right. Bye.